Good afternoon, members. I call this meeting of the Property Tax Division to order pursuant to Rule 10.01. The first order of business is that we need to take a roll call to determine who's present. The clerk, Mr. Peterson, will now take the roll.
Chair Joachim?
Present.
Vice Chair Gomez? Representative Hertas?
Hertas present.
Hertas present. Representative Anderson?
Anderson present.
Anderson present. Representative Becker Finn?
Present.
Becker Finn present. Representative Fisher? Representative Green?
Present.
Green present. Representative Hassan? Representative Herr?
Present.
Herr present. Representative Marquardt?
Present.
Okay. Marquardt present.
And please just call
Representative Mortensen?
Present.
Okay, thank you.
Mortensen present. Representative Plowski?
Plowski present.
Plowski present. Representative Torkelson?
Present.
Torkelson present. Vice Chair Gomez? Representative Fisher? Representative Hassan?
Present.
Hassan present. That concludes the roll, and a quorum is present.
Thank you, Mr. Peterson. I want to note that all the committee documents for today have been sent to members and are on the committee page on the House website. The first item on the agenda is the approval of the minutes from February 10th. Representative Becker Finn, have you had a chance to review the minutes?
Yes, Madam Chair, and I would move the minutes of February 10th.
Thank you, Representative Becker Finn. Does anyone have any questions about those minutes? Seeing none, we'll move on to the vote. And this is a voice vote, so members, please briefly unmute yourselves when you vote. All those in favor of approving the February 10th minutes, say aye.
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 All those opposed? The motion is approved and the minutes are adopted. Okay. Representative Gomez is here. And the first item of the agenda is for the Office of the State Auditor on their Tax Increment Financing Legislative Report. Mr. Nord, please introduce yourself for the record and proceed with your presentation.
Sure. Can you hear me okay?
Yes, we can hear you just fine.
Very good. Well, thank you, Madam Chair. My name for the record is Jason Nord. I'm the TIF Division Director at the Office of the State Auditor, and thank you for having me. I'll be giving a brief overview of tax increment financing and some of the issues that you might encounter as a committee, while also sharing information from our new legislative report that was released last week. There's also a handout of the material I'm covering in case I move a little bit fast here. There's a lot of things I could potentially go on and on about, so I'll try and move quickly. So first, our role at the Office of the State Auditor is to provide oversight of tax increment financing, and we do that by collecting annual reporting. We collect over 1,600 reports for over 1,600 districts from over 400 TIF authorities, along with a couple hundred other filings each year. Statute authorizes us to examine the use of tax increment financing, and we largely work with authorities more informally to kind of identify and work through issues and help remedy any problems that pop up, although we are also able to provide more formal notices of noncompliance when the situation calls for it, and those are included in the legislative report. There was one of those in this year's report. But I think an important part of improving compliance with tax increment financing laws is to provide training and education to help authorities understand the complexities of TIF and how to stay in compliance. So that's an important aspect of what we do as well. What is TIF? TIF is a financing tool primarily for redevelopment, housing, and economic development. It's not a tax break. The taxpayers of developed property pay their full taxes, but the taxes on the new value finance development activity instead of local levies. So the new net tax capacity generated in a TIF district does not support local government levies for you know, city schools and counties. It instead finances the activities. And if I enlarge this example here, you can see an example where maybe before development, you might have a blighted commercial space that with an original net tax capacity of, say, $3,250. And perhaps the new development will add a substantial amount of new net tax capacity. So it's important to understand that in the eyes of the tax base, the property for the duration of the district remains kind of the $3,250 of value, and that additional value is not part of the tax base for the full duration of the TIF district.
Mr. Nord, I'm just going to quick interrupt just to remind folks that you can go to the speaker view so that you could see Mr. Nord's presentation. And I have to say, Office of the State Auditor for the win, already it's a more creative presentation than we've had than sharing your screen. So thank you.
Well, I have to give credit to State Auditor Blaha. She's found this tool and has encouraged us to use it as well. So it's kind of fun to go through it this way, although I don't need to be on camera. But it is what it is. It's important then to understand that TIF impacts all local taxing jurisdictions and not just the jurisdiction that is using it. So it might be a little bit different than the tax abatement program in that regard. The captured value in a TIF district is excluded when tax rates are calculated. And that's so that the local levies the tax rates will raise the entire local levies. The local jurisdictions aren't shorted at all, but it means there's additional taxes being levied above and beyond what the levies are, and those are the tax increments. So the merits of TIF really hinge on what's called a but-for test. And when a municipality decides it wants to make use of tax increment financing, it has to be able to come to the conclusion that but for the use of TIF, the development would not occur. And if that's true, then that means that there's really no stress on tax base and tax rates because the value wouldn't exist anyway. And so it wouldn't cause a problem. But if that test doesn't hold up very well, and if some of that value would have occurred without TIF, then the use of TIF is potentially putting strain on tax base and tax rates and maybe not as good of a thing. And so TIF is really meant to address market failures, such as blight and the undersupply of affordable housing by the market. It's not meant to just assist with any development projects that come along. This graphic shows the municipalities that are using TIF are called TIF authorities. And these maps show where TIF authorities are located. You can see they're spread all across the state. Basically almost every city over 5,000 and a large number of small cities either have used or are using TIF. And there's even a dozen or so county HRAs that make use of TIF. So it's pretty widespread. This graphic shows the process of creating a TIF district. And it begins with drafting a TIF plan. That plan then must be shared with the county and the school district to get their comments and feedback. Although the municipality is not bound at all by that feedback, except for perhaps in certain circumstances where county road costs have to be included. But beyond that, they have to publish a notice for a public hearing to give the public an opportunity to weigh in on a proposed use of TIF. And once that hearing occurs, then the municipality can approve the plan. And at that time, they request certification by the county auditor so that the county auditor can get it all set up in the tax system. And they send a copy of the TIF plan to us and a copy to the Department of Revenue. There's a couple of topics or subjects that come up frequently that with issues. And the biggest of those is pooling, which is maybe a little bit of a strange term. Pooling refers to the spending of increment outside the TIF district, but within a broader project area. The statutes that allow the use of TIF also create project areas, which can be very large, even the whole city. But the TIF districts generally are a parcel or a few parcels where the development is occurring, and that generates the tax increments. So there are some limits on pooling. The overall limit is for a redevelopment district, up to 25% of tax increment can be pooled outside the district. For all other district types, it's 20%. There's also a 5-year rule that puts a timing parameter on it. So generally speaking, in order for expenditures to be considered in district, they have to be incurred or obligated within the first 5 years. So if after the first 5 years you identify new spending, that has to fit within your pooling limits. And there's a corresponding six-year rule to the five-year rule that says beginning in the sixth year, on an annual basis, the in-district share of increments must be spent on the in-district obligations. And once those obligations, once there's sufficient increment to pay those obligations, generally speaking, the district must be decertified. So it promotes early decertification. Another topic that can get a little bit confusing is the idea of decertification. Decertification is when the TIF district is terminated, meaning it'll no longer create any more tax increments. But that doesn't mean the TIF district is really done. The TIF district must continue to comply and report to us until tax increment is either properly spent or returned. So like out of the 1600 TIF districts that reported in 2019, over 200 of them were reporting for decertified districts. I could go on forever about the history of TIF, but very briefly, it might be helpful to understand that the TIF Act was created in 1979 to provide common procedures and basic limitations on the use of TIF. And that caused the use of TIF to explode throughout the 80s and 90s. And the legislature had significant concerns and annually was dealing with TIF issues and passed numerous reforms over those two decades, including some big reforms in the 1990s. And then in 2001, the tax reform changed the dynamic between TIF and school aids. Prior to that, when jurisdictions were using TIF, it was causing school aids to increase. But the 2001 reforms changed that dynamic quite a bit. And so since 2001, you haven't seen very frequent TIF issues popping up, but you do get your annual list of special legislation requests. So our office actually would like to see some clarifications to various areas of TIF law. Right now we're working with stakeholders to review some ideas. And once those are ready, we'll be bringing those forward to you. If not this session, then maybe next. So, and some of the special legislation bills that you'll receive, will involve maybe the five-year rule, give an extension to the five-year rule, or perhaps a duration extension for the entire TIF district. Or there's different municipalities that feel like they should be able to use a redevelopment district for a unique situation that maybe doesn't fit with the law's general blight requirements. So you'll see a lot of those. And then just a variety of exceptions to various limits. And out of the districts that reported in the 1600 districts that reported for 2019, 116 of them reported being subject to a special law. The rest of my slides here are gonna deal with data from our legislative report. So I'll just kind of go through them quickly and you can digest what you're interested in more later. But this chart shows the number of districts by type for statewide Greater Minnesota and the metro area. You can see that 97% of all districts fall in the big three categories of redevelopment, housing, and economic development. And most TIF districts are actually located in Greater Minnesota. 63% of TIF districts are located in Greater Minnesota. This chart though shows the revenues by district type, statewide, Greater Minnesota, and metro. And here you can see that the vast majority of the revenue is actually collected in the metro area, which makes some sense because valuations are higher in the metro and projects tend to be a little bit larger in scope. But there was $243 million statewide of tax increment revenues in 2019. These pie charts just show the distribution of the counts of TIF districts and the dollars by district type. And one thing to note here is that while redevelopment districts account for a little less than half of all districts, they account for almost three quarters of all the increment. This chart shows kind of the history of TIF revenue in Minnesota since its inception. The blue line is actual dollars and the orange is inflation adjusted. You can see the exponential growth through the 80s, and that growth trend line started to level off a little bit after the 1990 reforms. And you can see the big impact of the 2001 tax reforms that cut tax increment revenues by 30% for 2002. But the trend continued to increase until 2008. And that's when kind of all the original TIF districts started hitting their duration limits. And so we had a wave of decertifications that brought the trend line down. It kind of leveled off in recent years here and is up the last couple of years. This is the same trend line except of the count of districts. It peaked slightly earlier than the dollars did in 2004 at over 2,200 districts and seems to have leveled off over the last few years at right around 1,650 districts. And that's kind of, that leveling off is illustrated by these trend lines that have converged. The blue line is the number of new districts created each year. The dotted purple line is the number of decertifications each year. So those have kind of been converging over the last few years, although there was a little bit of a surprising dip in decertifications this last year. This chart might be of interest to many of you. It shows the impact of early decertification. So for all the districts that have decertified over the last 5 years, it shows what percentage decertified early. So 63% of redevelopment districts decertify early, almost 80% of housing districts. And even though economic development districts have a much shorter duration, there's still 30% of those that decertify early. And it's not just by a year or two, but the last column shows the average number of years early that those districts decertified. So it can be 10 or 11 years early for redevelopment and housing districts. And that shows, some of this show might show districts not getting off the ground. That could skew some of the averages, but a lot of this shows the impact of the six-year rule. And then we also reported the total amount of TIF debt in the report. 64% of the little over $1.6 billion of debt is in pay-as-you-go obligations. And with pay-as-you-go obligations, the developer or a note holder is fronting all of the costs, and they're being repaid with tax increment each year as that increment is collected. So that puts the risk on the developer, whereas with general obligation bonds, the risks are on the municipalities, and where if the increment wasn't sufficient, taxpayers would be on the hook. So general obligation bonds used to be much more popular. They're not as much so anymore. As the PAYGO debt is better in terms of risk for municipalities. And interfund loans have also become kind of a significant share of total debt. And then lastly, in 2019, there was $8.6 million returned to the counties to be redistributed as general taxes to the cities, counties, and school districts. And the return of increment might occur when a district just produces more money than what was needed. Or some of these return amounts could be to remedy problems or errors where money was spent in conflict with statutes. So that's kind of the whirlwind overview of TIF. And I'd just like to say that if the committee ever has issues that arises in the future, by all means, please feel free to contact us and let us share our expertise with you. So with that, if there's any questions, I'd be happy to address them.
Thank you, Mr. Nord. I suggest reading the report too. It was very helpful. Members, are there any questions for Mr. Nord? Representative Hertaus.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Mr. Nord, just backing up a few slides to your comments about the debt service and the pay as you go. Could you maybe just comment for the benefit of members in explaining TIF, those circumstances in which there may be some shared risk or kind of the public-private partnership kind of arrangement?
Sure. Mr. Nord.
Sure, Madam Chair, Representative Hertaus. Yeah, with a pay-as-you-go obligation, the developer generally fronts all of the costs, and then that note can be held by another note holder. But that way, if the tax increment revenue streams don't bear out with what was expected, just the developer or the note holder isn't going to be reimbursed for all of their expenses. And that's become the most common financing arrangement. Whereas with, previously back in the 80s, it was much more common for the municipality to issue a general obligation bond or maybe a revenue bond. And then if the rec- if the increments weren't sufficient, they would kind of be on the hook for those bonds. So that's kind of been the big trend over the last few years. And with an interfund loan, the municipality is essentially fronting the money, maybe with other funds that are available, and is repaying those other funds with tax increments. That's how the interfund loans work. But did that answer the question?
Representative Hertaus?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Mr. Nord. Yeah, it pretty much did, and I know how some of these things work, but just for the benefit of the members and the new members to the committee, I just, you know, was trying to touch a little bit on how some of these proposals are integral in terms of the financing and what makes it go or not go using TIF. And sometimes there is a little bit of a shared risk. You referred to it as interfund money, but sometimes I've been aware where some of the community issues part general obligation bonds and the other part is private sector risk. Mm-hmm.
Thank you. Members, any other questions? Seeing none, thank you so much, Mr. Nord. And next up, we have Representative Caleb Berg for House File 618. Can I get somebody in the division to move House File 618 before the division?
So move, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Representative Hertaus. Representative Hertaus moves House File 618 be laid over for possible inclusion in the division report. We have the bill before us now. Representative Berg, welcome to Property Tax Committee. Please present your bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. Just a brief overview of the bill. It authorizes special rules for the City of Burnsville to create redevelopment TIF districts within the limited area of the Burnsville Center and adjacent rights of way. It's my understanding it was carried in the previous session's omnibus bill. And so I have a couple of really great testifiers here today. So Madam Chair, if I could turn it over to our fantastic mayor, Mayor Coutts.
Thank you, Representative Berg. Mayor Coutts, welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the Property Tax Committee. My name is Elizabeth Coutts. I'm the mayor of the city of Burnsville, and I have been the mayor for 25 years. I thank you for allowing us to speak with you about our desire, and also ask for your support and partnership and approval to help us with the redevelopment of the Burnsville Shopping Center using tax increment financing. Madam Chair and members of the committee, the Burnsville Center was built in the late 1970s at the intersection of I-35W and County Road 42, just north of the I-35W and I-35E split. The Burnsville Shopping Center was one of the handful of regional indoor malls that brought commerce, jobs, and entertainment to the communities in our metropolitan area. But times have changed. That was 44 years ago, and so much has changed since then. Who would have thought we would be buying shoes and clothing, sitting from home without trying them on, or having hot meals delivered to our front door, or watching movies on our iPhones? Over the past 40 plus years, the shopping center brought commerce, jobs, taxes, food and entertainment to the South Metro region and the County Road 42 corridor. But what was once a center of activity in the area is no longer. Activity surrounds the mall, but the core is disappearing rapidly. There was a time when the mall was full of activity and you could not find a parking spot. Now cars are stored there and you can pick your spot wherever you want. It appears to be a matter of time before we lose another anchor. Madam Chair and members of the committee, the tax values are declining rapidly. That's why viability of the shopping center area is one of Burnsville's top priorities. because we know that what impacts Burnsville also impacts the state revenues. And we want to ensure that not only is Burnsville thriving, but the state continues to thrive, and that we do our part in helping that thriving. In 2019, we approved the Center Village Vision Plan, which is a long-range framework for the redevelopment of the area. This plan will guide future decision-making, investments, and priorities for transforming the area from all commercial area with large underutilized parking priorities into a mixed-use development. We want it to be vibrant and to have a neighborhood that is filled with vitality. Think and imagine housing, jobs, density, green space, sustainability, entertainment, mass transit, and so much more. A vibrant mixed-use development, a vibrant mixed-use community. The primary goal of our request is to have the tools necessary to ensure our plan is feasible. Our request is the exact same language as last year. In 2020, this request was generally supported by the legislature. The only reason it did not pass was because of COVID and the lack of bills being heard and voted on due to the pandemic. The proposed legislation provides the tool necessary to ensure the city's plans for future of the Burnsville Center and the surrounding retail area are financially feasible and will allow us to put in place the infrastructure necessary to transform the area. I can assure you, as mayor of the city of Burnsville, that we don't just create tax districts just to create them. And also, Madam Chair and members of the committee, in the last 25 years since I've been mayor, ours have all been pay-go. To date, and as decades long as TIF districts have been authorized, we have only created 8 TIF districts, and we only have 2 that are active today. We only create them if they meet the specific vision and policy objectives. And after thorough review of the but-for test established by the legislature. Madam Chair and members of the committee, I close with asking for the legislature to help us pass this bill. We are asking for this legislation because experience has taught us that redevelopment takes time. We are asking for your support and partnership for this legislation that will allow us to have tools to facilitate redevelopment of the Burnsville Center and to improve transportation in the County Road 42 corridor. Our transformative vision for the area will not only benefit Burnsville, but will be a benefit to the region and to the state. The state revenue will increase, and Burnsville will also benefit, but all Minnesotans will also benefit. So we thank you very much for your consideration of our request. And Madam Chair, with me also is our city manager, Melanie Mescoli, and I ask that you also recognize her, please.
Thank you, Mayor and Council. Ms. Lee, please state your name for the record and proceed.
Can't hear you, Melanie.
Excuse me. Good afternoon, Madam Chair and legislators. My name is Melanie Mescoli. I'm the Burnsville City Manager. Thank you for allowing me to speak today. As the mayor mentioned, with this bill, we are asking for the same language that was supported in 2020. We believe that this request is simple, straightforward, and does not cost the taxpayers any money. The request seeks 3 things: to have the Burnsville Center qualify for TIF to meet the blight standard, to allow for the use of TIF to be spent on more than the correction of the blight so that Number three, it allows use of the proceeds for a new safety crossing at County Road 42. Burnsville Center consists of 1.1 million square feet. It was built in 1977, as the mayor mentioned, has four separate owners and consists of five parcels. The buildings are functionally and economically obsolete. It's a fading regional destination, and it has one of the highest vacancies in the metro, if not the highest. The former Sears building has been vacant since 2017, and COVID has simply made the conditions worse. The tax value at this site has decreased 46% since 2018, and we anticipate that it will go down at least another 20% given the recent auction. This is hurting all the taxpayers, the city, school district, the county, and the state. In addition to our efforts to facilitate redevelopment of the Burnsville Center shopping area, we anticipate significant public investment in transportation and pedestrian enhancements along the adjacent County Road 42 and Ring Road surrounding the mall. Securing a funding source for these project costs are critical to a positive outcome and for a reimagined commercial district. Thank you so much for your time. This is a small thing that you could do to help, and we are asking for your help. Thank you so much for your time and your consideration, and we would be happy to stand for any questions.
Thank you, Ms. Lee. Members, are there any questions for Representative Berg or her testifiers? Representative Green.
Thank you, Madam Chair. In listening to the testimony, some things did pop into my mind, and if Burnsville wants to use the financing, I guess I have no problem with that. But it doesn't sound like you really, or at least I didn't really hear a specific plan on what you have coming forward, except for you just want to enhance it. And the idea is that someone's going to have to own that and run a business in there, or who are you going to tax? You know, so you need something in there that's viable. What is the plan for that?
Representative Berg or one of your testifiers?
I will refer that question to Melanie or the mayor.
Who would like to take that?
Madam Chair, Mayor Elizabeth Coutts. Representative Green, we do have a plan in place, as I mentioned, and the plan has been adopted. And right now, we have four owners to the mall. So we have met with them a week ago with the owners of the mall, and to share with them again, because they were part of the visioning process for the mall and what we would like to see it redeveloped to. So once we have the tools in place, Representative Green, what would happen is that it's like a playbook that's laid out for the developers, for the owners and the developers to understand what all of the regulatory tools are and what are the economic tools that are available for them. So I would also ask Madam Chair if Ms. Lee has something else to add to that. And we also have a couple of our consultants and economic development director also with us. But Madam Chair, if City Manager Lee has any more to add to my remarks.
Ms. Lee.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Mayor Coutts. I think you covered the big picture of it fairly well, Madam Mayor, so thank you for responding. I'll look back to Representative Green to see if he has further questions or if we were able to answer his inquiry.
Representative Green.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I guess it's answered as good as it maybe can be. I just didn't see a specific plan. And so without a specific plan, I'm been in business for a while, and it's just having a vision is one thing, but putting together a plan, a viable plan, is something else. And so if the mall is not functioning right now, then it seems like a pretty big risk if there's not a definite plan in place with a business plan. But I won't belabor the subject. It's your city, so we'll make your own decisions.
Mayor Coates, you had your hand raised.
Yes. Thank you, Madam Chair and Representative Green. We do have a plan in place. I'm sorry that it did not get to you. One of the things that we will make sure is that the plan for the mall is in your hands, Madam Chair and members of the committee. We want to be transparent in all things that we do. And so the plan is in place.
Thank you, Representative Hurtas.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Madam Mayor, for your presentation. I just wanted to comment that a group of baby boomers that I hang out with make an annual endeavor to slide down a big hill behind the mall. And we usually end the evening with having dinner over there. I've frequented the mall in the last several years, and I will just attest to Representative Berg and Madam Mayor and the officials from the city of Burnsville that this tool, having it, you know, as a tool in the toolbox, if you will allow the developers and the owners of the project to go forward. It is a situation that is thriving all around it, but it does need a little bit of an uplift. So thank you for asking for this help, and I think it's a project well deserved.
Thank you, Representative Hurtas. I don't see any other questions. Representative Berg, final comments.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'll just close by saying I grew up in Northfield, which is about 30 minutes south of Burnsville. And a big outing was to go to the Burnsville Mall. And that was true of sort of the surrounding area as Lakeville was getting built up. And I bought a lot of really terrible clothes there in the 90s. And it was an actual outing. And the location is fantastic, and with the revitalization of it, this is going to be a destination. So not only is it going to serve the families in our district as they're looking for places to gather and take their children and have entertainment and green spaces to be outside and places to walk, but it's also going to bring other families from the surrounding area and revenue back into our city. And so the plans as they stand today, the mayor will get that into your hands. They're really exciting to see, and I thank you for the opportunity to present this to you today.
Thank you, Representative Berg. Representative Hurtas renews his motion that House File 618 be laid over for possible inclusion in the division.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'll renew my motion to have House File 618 laid over for possible inclusion into a division report.
Thank you, Representative Hurtas. I'm sorry, I should have called for you to do that. Representative Hurtas renews his motion that House File 618 be laid over for possible inclusion in the division report. So it is, and thank you, Representative Berg, you're on your way. Next, we have House File 736. This is Representative Driscoll's bill, but he can't get out of another committee that he's in presenting a bill, so Representative Hurtas has agreed to present the bill on his behalf. Representative Hurtas, would you like to move this bill for possible inclusion?
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. I move that House File number 736 be laid over for possible inclusion in a division report.
Representative Hurtas moves that House File 736 be laid over for possible inclusion in the division report. So now we have the bill in front of us. Representative Hurtas, please proceed or feel free to turn it over to the testifier or however you'd like.
Thank you, Madam Chair. House File 736 is a local option sales tax that would be implemented upon food and liquor only in the community. And we have with us today Mayor Ryan Fitsum, the Sartell mayor. And I believe he brought his city administrator along as well. So with that, Madam Chair, I'll turn it over to those folks to provide a little bit more information and detail about the bill.
Thank you, Representative Hurtas. Mayor Fitzsimmons, boy, I am just tongue-tied today. Sorry about that. Mayor Fitzsimmons, please introduce yourself for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Representative Hurtas. Mayor Ryan Fitzsimmons from the city of Sartell. And this bill is items being brought forward for technical modification. It had expired in 2021 due to COVID implications. 2020, we did not bring this, excuse me, it expired in 2020. Due to technical implications, we did not bring this forward for consideration of the local authorization, which then expired it. We're simply looking for the legislature to reauthorize us to bring this forward for local consideration. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Mayor Fitzsimmons. Do you have anyone else with you? I don't know that I'm a, I don't have it on my notes, but I'm just going to see if folks have any questions for you. Members, any questions? Seems like a pretty straightforward bill. Seeing no questions, Representative Hertaz, would you, Representative Hertaz renews his motion that House File 736, or actually, Representative Hertaz, you have some closing comments.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And yes, I do renew my motion that House File 736 be laid over for possible inclusion. I think, it, as you mentioned, it is a pretty straightforward bill. It's about imposing a local option tax on food and liquor, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Representative Hertaz. Representative Hertaz renews his motion that House File 736 be laid over for possible inclusion in the division report. So the bill's laid over, and we will move on. So we have House File 551 from Representative Cleavorn. Members, could I get a motion to move House File 551 before the division?
So moved, Madam Chair.
Representative Jamie Becker-Finn moves House File 551 be laid over for possible inclusion in the division report. We'll have the bill before us now. Representative Cleavorn, to your bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members, and thank you, Representative Becker-Finn, for making the motion for us. Today, I want to begin first with a thank you for supporting House File 877 in 2019 and allowing Plymouth to have a local option sales tax. So that's huge, and I want to say thank you for that. And today, I'm here to talk about House File 551, which is of the removing of the expiration date that had been applied to House File 877 when it was passed. Just by way of background, I would like to say in February of 2019, I came before this committee requesting authorization for the City of Plymouth to impose a new and special 3% lodging tax under general law. The revenues from this special 3% tax are required to be split 1% for convention and tourism, that's marketing and promotion, and 2% for capital improvements to public recreational facilities. This 3% special lodging tax is separate from the 3% lodging tax allowed under general law and referenced in the Hospitality Minnesota letter received by the committee. To be clear, we are not discussing the tax referenced in the letter to the committee by Hospitality Minnesota. At the time of our initial hearing, Plymouth reserved the right to, at a later date, if appropriate and warranted, to implement that 3% general lodging tax. At the time of passage of the special Plymouth lodging tax, a sunset of 10 years was added. This sunset language was not in the original House File 877. Nor was it requested by the City of Plymouth. In my research for today's bill, I found no other sunset for local lodging taxes. This is why I come before you today to ask for your support and inclusion in your division report of House File 551, which would eliminate the sunset provision. Plymouth is the home location to the Plymouth Ice Center, the Plymouth Creek Center, the Hildy Performance Center, and expansive parks and trails. These facilities are heavily used by the greater regional community. In addition, the Plymouth Creek Center, or the Plymouth Ice Center, is a regional, state, and national youth hockey asset. This special lodging tax we requested was implemented in October of 2020. It is a win-win for the hospitality community, and it provides public recreational assets that serve our region and our state. These important public recreational assets draw tourists from the region, from across our state, and our nation. Further, in my conversations with Hospitality Minnesota, I want to recognize that it also meets their needs. It promotes and supports ongoing tourism for Plymouth, and it would work to put more heads in the beds, as they like to say. It enhances our regional recreational assets to be more attractive to tourism. The important part is, without these ongoing resources, Plymouth is not able to create and sustain a leading tourism convention position in our state, which is why we are here today before you. With me today are Mayor Jeff Washey and City Manager Dave Callister. And with that, Madam Chair, I would ask that you please recognize Mayor Washey.
Thank you, Representative Cleavorn. Mayor Washey, welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair and committee members. My name is Jeff Washey. I'm the Mayor of Plymouth. Thank you for allowing me to testify on this bill. And thank you for Representative Cleavorn for carrying this. I just want to emphasize the regional aspects of Plymouth and our recreational facilities as Representative Cleavorn and give you some facts and figures. We have about, there's about 1.5 million people that live within 10 miles of our three major facilities, which includes our ICE Center, our Creek Center, and the Hildy Performance Center. And many more travel to Plymouth from around the region and from other states to use these facilities, as well as other Plymouth facilities. And we welcome these visitors, but the City of Plymouth does bear a regional burden as it provides recreational facilities that provide benefit far beyond our city limits. So pre-COVID, for example, city recreation facilities were attracting hundreds of thousands of visitors annually. Our Plymouth Creek Center had over 300,000 visitors. Our ICE Center, over 450,000 visitors. Our Hildy Performance Center, which is our amphitheater, had almost 65,000 visitors in 2019. Our Northwest Greenway, which is over a 300 mile of reserved wood facilities, attracted almost 500,000 people in this last year alone. I'm sure COVID prompted people to get outdoors a lot, as we know. And then our Plymouth Creek Center field house is also used by 13 high schools, 18 athletic associations, and 12 universities from across the region and out of state. So this is a high demand. This high demand brings in lots of visitors into Plymouth and the surrounding area, and it's great for the economy. As representative, it puts heads in, Cleavorn says that it puts heads in beds. And our hotel business really benefits from this. I know if I'm at one of our local hotels on a Friday night, I was there for a meeting, and on the way out, I saw all these players and their parents coming in, and you could tell they're hockey players because they have those big bags with all their hockey equipment in it. They're dragging up to their rooms. So we know that those hotels gain the benefit of those, the recreation that's put on in Plymouth. But it's right now, it's overburdening the city and our taxpayers because we have to pay the full freight of that. That's why we're asking for this action on this. So while the lodging tax is set to sunset after 10 years, that demand placed on our city facilities will continue along with the associated costs by our taxpayers. So with that, I'm concluding my comments.
Thank you, Mayor Washey. Next up, Mr. McAllister, welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair and representatives. My name is Dave Callister, and I am the city manager in Plymouth. And I want to provide some additional background on the status of the current lodging tax in Plymouth. As Representative Cleavorn indicated, we began collecting the lodging tax on October 1st in 2020, so we only have 3 or 4 months under our belts. But obviously, due to COVID and its impact on the hospitality industry, we estimate that in the first year of lodging tax collections, we will collect about 40% of what we projected. So there's quite a reduction that we and many, all communities are seeing in their hotel stays. Now, the pre-COVID estimate for the total lodging tax revenue was about $667,000 per year, and we now expect to collect about $255,000 per year. So that's about a 62% decrease from the earlier estimates. So the current statute has been indicated already is that we can collect for this lodging tax for up to 10 years or until September of 2030. Two-thirds of the lodging tax is dedicated to paying a portion of the annual debt that we issued in 2020 for the Plymouth Creek Center improvements, which was the main reason for the special legislation. The debt has a repayment of 20 years, and we will be paid in full on the debt in 2041. So there's 10 or 11 years of debt that we will not have the lodging tax under the current law, and we are looking to take the sunset date off of the lodging tax and that be eliminated so that we can collect the lodging tax as many other governments are doing. There are currently 16 local governments that have special legislation for lodging tax revenue for many purposes, including some who are collecting lodging taxes for general revenue or general fund purposes. We certainly are not doing that. We have a focused effort and it's based on recreational tourism. But Plymouth is the only one of those 16 cities that has an expiration date or a sunset date on the lodging tax. And so eliminating the arbitrary sunset date will help align us with other local lodging taxes, as well as help us pay our debt going forward for the Plymouth Creek Center project. So we thank the chair and the committee for the opportunity to testify on this important matter. And please let us know if you have any questions regarding any components of this proposed legislation. Thank you for your time.
Thank you, Mr. Callister. Members, I think before we go on to others that have signed up to testify, I want to see if members have any questions for Representative Cleavorn or any of her testifiers. Seeing none so far, we'll move on to those who've signed up to testify. We have a Mr. Quillis has signed up to give testimony on this bill. Mr. Quillis, please introduce yourself for the record. Proceed with your testimony.
Afternoon, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Just want to make sure first you can hear me, correct?
Yes, we can.
And I'm right side up and I don't have a cat in front of my face, which are kind of the three requirements now as we go through and do these Zoom meetings.
Check, but Madam Chair, check. We're all go.
I'm Tony Coolis, and I'm representing the Minnesota Association of Convention Bureau. And just to make a couple of brief comments on House File 551, but I'd like to start off by thanking Representative Cleavorn for her open door policy. We had a good discussion about House File 551 and how we spend Valentine's Day and New Year's Eve with our families. And we're on an agreement on how we do that. But unfortunately, we parted ways on House File 551. Madam Chair, to go back to how we got to this point, under Minnesota Statutes 469.1.90, cities already have the authority to enact a local lodging tax up to 3%, as long as 95% of that lodging tax is used to create a Visitors and Convention Bureau. And so you don't have to come to the legislature if you just do that. The only reason you have to come to the legislature is if you want to go above that 3% or you want to use the proceeds for something other than creating a Visitors and Convention Bureau. And as Representative Cleavorn pointed out on House File 877, Plymouth came in 2019 to do two things. One, to go above the existing 3%, that they could go up to 3% above the 3 that's existing, which I think they only did the 3, but then also to use it for capital improvement projects. And Madam Chair, we have always at the Visitors Convention Bureau opposed using any lodging taxes for capital projects. We think that local sales taxes, property taxes, fees, or even a bonding bill would be a better way than to ask one industry to provide money for a capital project, Madam Chair. So in the end, what the legislature did and created kind of a hybrid model where they said Plymouth can go up to 6%. They could go up to 6%. I don't think they have. They can clarify that, but they could go up to 6%. And then they said two-thirds of this can be used for capital and projects. one third for a visitors convention bureau, and then we're going to sunset it. And that's where you see the legislation 19 months later now, we're back and we're trying to remove the sunset. And that's our concern, Madam Chair, of that was kind of what the deal was, you know, we didn't like the capital improvement. They didn't want to create a visitors convention bureau or have a sunset. And so that's why we have the concerns about House File 551. And then one last point, Madam Chair, we talked about there were other folks that have got local lodging taxes and they're not, you know, they're being used for general fund and other things. There was lodging taxes in place in Rochester, St. Cloud, Bloomington, Duluth, St. Paul, Minneapolis. There was, it's a long history and I don't want to get into it, but there was a number of them that were grandfathered in throughout the years when we went through and made some changes to the tax code. And so they got grandfathered in, Madam Chair. And so I just wanted to take the time and thank you and committee members for allowing me to voice my concerns about House File 551. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Quillas. Members, are there any questions for this testifier? Seeing none, I'm going to go on to the other person who signed up to testify. We also have Mr. Wogsland signed up to give testimony on the bill. Mr. Wogsland, could you please introduce yourself for the record and proceed with your testimony?
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Ben Wogsland. I'm the Government Affairs Director for Hospitality Minnesota, representing Minnesota's hotels, restaurants, resorts, and campgrounds. Thank you for having me today. I would also like to say thank you to Representative Cleve Warren, the author, for acknowledging our conversations from last biennium. And I'd like to say thank you to the mayor as well for eloquently talking about their view of the need of this project. And, you know, we certainly don't begrudge the city the desire to fund capital projects. We just do not believe that this is the most appropriate way to do that by putting it right on the backs of hotels and lodging properties. This is a, you know, additional tax above and beyond for hotels and in lodging. And as the previous testifier mentioned, the longstanding statutory purpose of the lodging tax and of lodging taxes in Minnesota was to dedicate 95% of those funds to marketing and promoting tourism that directly impacts those hotels and lodging properties. So it has been the longstanding position of Hospitality Minnesota that we believe that is the appropriate use of any additional lodging taxes. And members, it really comes down to this, you know, hotels and lodging properties do not mind paying their fair share in a lodging tax when they know that the funds are essentially going to be used directly to market and promote visitors coming to their hotels and their lodging properties. Where they have an issue is when it's redirected or diverted to capital improvement projects, as the previous testifier said. And so we just wanted to put those comments on the record here. Look forward to talking to the author a little bit more as this session progresses, and maybe the mayor in Plymouth as well. We've had some previous correspondence with them, but wanted to put that on the record here today. And thank you, Madam Chair and members, for allowing me to speak.
Thank you, Mr. Wogsland. Members, any questions for Mr. Wogsland? Seeing none, Representative Cleve Warren, final comments.
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair and members. And I really do appreciate a robust conversation. And my door is always open to you, and I'm looking for ways that we can partner. I do see this bill as a partnership. It is true that no one wants to pay any sort of additional tax. We never want to. This I see as a pass-through, and the hotels collect, and then we use it together to continue to grow and build our communities. So I thank you for the pushback and the robust conversation. Madam Chair, today we're just here to ask for a sunset. As we move forward with our public recreational assets and enhance them to improve tourism and hospitality community, it's a win-win for us. And when we have more people coming into Plymouth to enjoy the amenities at the Plymouth Creek Center, whether it's hosting a business convention, having a wedding celebration, or working together for some other project. it does bring people to our community, and they do stay in our hotels. They do eat at the restaurants. And it is, communities are about partnership and working together to make good things happen. And I ask this committee to please allow us to continue to grow and develop our community for more tourism, for a more robust economy, and for the citizens of our community and state. And with that, I ask for support of House File 551 to be included in your division report.
Thank you. Thank you, Representative Cleburne. Representative Becker Finn renews her motion that House File 551 be laid over for possible inclusion in the division report. So the bill is laid over. Representative Cleburne, you're on your way. Thank Next you. Up and last, we have House File 759 from Representative Petersburg. Can I get a motion to move House File 759 before the division?
So moved, Madam Chair. I'll move House File 759 be considered to be laid over for possible inclusion in the division report.
Representative Hertas moves House File 759 be laid over for possible inclusion in the division report. Now we have the bill before us. Representative Petersburg, to your bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, committee, for hearing this bill. It's nice to be back in this committee again. I was there last biennium, and so I appreciate all that. This bill is one that you heard before, and matter of fact, it passed out of this committee and was actually included in Chair Marquardt's budget bill or tax bill. Unfortunately, as we had to rework that bill, it got dropped off. But it's a fairly simple bill in which we're just trying to help farmers and others that are getting up there in age to be able to pass on an easier time of passing on ag land to their relatives. And so basically what we're doing, and it's only one line change, it's on line 2.33, in which we just expand the number of people as a relative that are included in being able to maintain the homestead exemption for the owner of the land. And it this now then will actually mirror what the residential exemption is, or the exemption, or the relative exemption that allows residential people to rent. And so if you go on to line 2.16 of the bill, you'll notice that with the additions that I'm adding, it will actually mirror the same relative ability to maintain that homestead exemption as in residential. And the reason why it's important is because we have, as I said before, people, baby boomers that are starting to think about retiring, et cetera. And yet we also want to promote family farms. We also want to promote the ability for young people to start farms. And even back when I farmed, which I did for many, many years, it was kind of a general rule of thumb that for every acre you wanted to buy, you needed to rent four more at reasonable rates. So this gives an opportunity for grandparents, aunts and uncles and others to be able to rent their property to a relative that is wanting to start and they wanted to help support without having to charge the extra tax that would have to be required if this wasn't enacted. So basically in a nutshell, that's what it is. I ask you for your support and hope that you will pass this on again and to help people with this particular issue. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Representative Petersburg. Members, any questions for Representative Petersburg? All right, actually, one thing I do want to point out to members is to be aware of the revenue estimate. This is the first time this year we're seeing an unknown on a revenue estimate, which isn't usually common, but happens occasionally in the tax committee and the property tax division. Maybe Ms. Schill, could you provide a little more detail on what the unknown means in general?
Good afternoon, Chair Joachim and members of the committee. Kathy Schill, House Fiscal Nonpartisan Staff. Yes, in this particular revenue estimate, you will see the scoring of unknown under three areas, including property tax refund interaction, agricultural homestead market value credit, and also the estate tax. When a revenue estimate has a score of unknown, that means that one or more criteria essential to getting an estimate for the provision in question is missing. And in this particular case, there are a couple things that are unknown. First of all, because this provision expands qualifying relatives to include grandparents, step-grandparents, step-children, aunts, uncles, nephews, and nieces, the actual number of relatives who would use this provision cannot be identified at this time. And remember, when you seek to participate in a homestead program, you must apply. So we cannot, at least the Department of Revenue at this time, doesn't know two important criteria. First of all, who would be eligible? And secondly, who would partake of the provision being adjusted here? I do have information on the number of parcels in Class 2A agricultural non-homestead property. There are about 132,000 parcels in this particular classification right now. And so matching those with the subset of potential users, that's, we just don't know. But that at least gives you an idea of the potential field and how big it is. And then I do have further information on agricultural market value credit if you want participants of that. But that's basically what is happening here and why this is scored as an unknown. And I would point out that it would be a cost. Those unknowns are in parentheses. That means it's a revenue loss. So beginning in fiscal 2023, there would be an unknown loss of revenue.
Madam Chair.
Thank you. Michelle, Representative Hertaz actually had his hand up and I missed it. So I'll have him go and then Representative Petersburg, I'll have you follow up. Representative Hertaz.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. And thank you, Rep. Peterson, for bringing this bill forward. Yes, you did bring it before committee before. And my recollection is some of the scenarios that we discussed previously about how this would apply is oftentimes we have to recognize that there's been a generational consolidation of farms all across greater Minnesota and other states. The numbers of people residing on farms has declined. Oftentimes in the consolidation of these farms, there may be habitable buildings, another home on an acquired piece or whatever. But more specifically to what you're trying to do, was most helpful because we had a number of younger farmers' relatives who actually were living on some of these additional parcels and actually actively farming in the operation and were not able to homestead that property because they didn't own the property. And so this is one of the applications where we were trying to extend this as we do with regard to residences in which people may own more than one house in town and their children, their adult children live in it, they're able to homestead the property. So this is a practical application. Thank you, Ms. Schill, for providing that information. 132,000, I think was the number you said, is all across the state. And I doubt that in every circumstance, probably only in a minimum of circumstances, there would actually be a relative who would be occupying that property and being allowed to homestead it. So we've already been through in the tax committee the differences with regard to property taxes when you're talking about thin margins in a farming operation. And this just becomes an extra burden, especially when a family member is actually residing on the property and actually active in the farming operation. So I hope that adds a little bit of clarity to what we talked about in a previous biennium, and I'll turn it over to Rep. Petersburg. Or actually, that's your job, Madam Chair, to do so. So thank you.
Thank you, Representative Hertaz. Representative Petersburg.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Michelle is right. We don't know how many are going to do that. However, the assumption is not many. The resulting factor is when the farmer is deciding that they want to retire and they have the ability to transfer it over or help somebody that's in their relative to rent that land so they can buy something else or sell it to a corporation or something of that nature. They really feel like it's important to be able to help out the young farmer. And they, rather than having to pass on the additional tax that they would have to do to that individual, it's important that they wanted to be able to give them a good start. As you can imagine, the size of equipment and the cost and so forth is extremely high. It is for all business, but farming especially. And this is just one way in which we can help. If the farmer had sold it to another farmer that was going to be active in farming, it would really make no change much. And so here we just, you know, the biggest impact might be those that are already currently had the availability and may choose to do this. But anybody in the future, it wouldn't change tax collections and so forth anyway. So it's a small part that we can do, I think, and one that I'm hope that you can support. And I just appreciate all of the discussion, and I appreciate your willingness to consider this. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Representative Petersburg. Representative Hertas, would you like to renew the motion?
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Rep. Petersburg. I will renew my motion that House File 759 be laid over for possible inclusion in the division report.
Representative Hertas renews his motion that House File 759 be laid over for possible inclusion in the division report. So the bill's laid over and you are on your way. Thank you for joining us today. Thank you for your work today, members, and for your questions. Next week, we'll be meeting at a regular time on Wednesday, February 24th. And members, I just kind of want to give you a heads up for future after that. We may be utilizing the tax committee time on March 4th and March 11th. Those are Thursdays to hear local option sales tax bills. So kind of keep that in the back of your mind and we'll let you know by next week. Until then, we are adjourned.